And now we present the next part of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Episode 20 is entitled Splendor and Decline.
The 13th century has been called the greatest of all the centuries, an age of rational and coherent advance in every sphere of life and thought.
Certainly, it was the richest cultural moment for the Europe of the Middle Ages.
It saw the growth of Gothic architecture, the poetry of Dante, the painting of Giotto.
Enthusiasm for learning was at its height, and the universities, led by Paris and Bologna, replaced the monasteries as centres of intellectual effort and attainment. They offered new ideas in law and theology, and a sound training in the liberal arts.
Philosophy emerged as a separate area of study. By the end of the century, canon law was also fixed in a scientific system, while almost every possible variety of religious organization had been established.
It was the age of wandering scholars who mingled with the mendicant friars on the crowded roads of Europe. It was the century which saw the fall of Byzantium and the weakening of the empire in the West, while to the east went Marco Polo and the last quarreling crusaders.
The coronation of the Pope in the Middle Ages was followed always by a triumphant cavalcade through the streets to the Lateran Palace. Immediately after his consecration in St. Peter's, the new Pope took his place on a throne at the top of the steps. The archdeacon removed the bishop's mitre from the Pope's head, replaced it with the papal tiara, and amid the joyous acclamation of the people, pronounced these words.
Take the tiara! And know that you are the father of princes and kings, ruler of the world, vicar on earth of our Saviour Jesus Christ, to whom honour and glory for eternity.
The Pope then mounted a white palfrey draped in scarlet, and the procession set off. First came cross-bearers, standard bearers with red banners, horsemen carrying lances adorned with golden cherubim, the papal archivist and lawyers in long black robes, the choir schools, the bishops and cardinals, and the Pope himself. The civil authorities and the militia followed, while bringing up the rear were knights in shining armour and the nobility resplendent in their family colours and displaying their coats of arms.
The whole of Rome was strung with garlands, and as the Pope passed under the triumphal arches erected along the papal way, he distributed largesse to the cheering crowds, while the bells pealed out over the city.
At the Lateran, the Pope was greeted with solemn chants and received the homage of the cathedral chapter. The prior gave him the crozier and keys of the church and palace, the former symbolizing his power to govern, the latter his power to loose and bind. The Pope was then draped with a purple silk sash, whose pocket held a handful of musk and 12 seals of precious stones, which symbolized apostolic power and Christian virtues.
The palace staff then came to kiss the Pope's foot, after which he tossed silver to the people, saying, "He distributed it and gave it to the poor. May his justice last forever." After praying a while before the relics in the Sancta Sanctorum, the Pope received the homage of the cardinals and prelates, each of whom held open his mitre, into which the Pope put the traditional offering of money, or presbyterium.
The Roman Senate swore the oath of fealty, and the day ended with a banquet, the Pope sitting alone, while prelates, nobility, senators and judges took their seats at other tables. The most important guests served the Pope with the first courses and then joined the rest of the company.
It was the English contemporary chronicler, Friar Thomas of Eccleston, who made the sad comment, "There is no one who dies as solitary and forsaken as a Pope." But a French bishop, Jacques de Vitry, who arrived in Italy in 1216 to take possession of his diocese, gives us a graphic picture of the sequel to a Pope's death.
In the June of that year, Innocent III was on his way north to Tuscany. He hoped to reconcile the powerful maritime states of Pisa and Genoa so that they would send crusaders to the east. But death overtook him in Perugia, where the Roman Curia were in residence, on the very morning of Dimitri's arrival. On the following day, the Pope's body was borne in an open coffin to the city's cathedral. Dimitri comments.
That was the day when I really understood the nothingness of earthly grandeur. Incredibly, the preceding night, thieves had entered and stripped the Pope of everything of value he had on. With my own eyes, I saw his half-naked body lying in the middle of the church.
And of the Curia, the bishop had nothing good to say.
The members are so taken up by temporal affairs and by lawsuits, and so preoccupied by everything having to do with kings and states, that one can scarcely touch upon questions pertaining to religion. All this caused me much grief.
The last pope of the century was Boniface VIII, another lawyer pope. Boniface was something of a patron of learning, encouraging several universities and founding the University of Rome.
But at the turn of the century, Boniface announced a most extraordinary event. From the loggia of St. John Lateran, he proclaimed the year 1300 to be a jubilee year, the first holy year in history. Special indulgences were attached to visiting Rome and making the rounds of the churches and the shrines. Pilgrims flocked to the city and the money poured in. Near the altar of St. Paul's outside the walls stood two clerics with rakes pulling the coins in. Although some have given the Pope credit for spiritual motives in proclaiming the Holy Year, it's generally accepted that he needed money, and what more legitimate way of procuring it?
Among the pilgrims who stood under the loggia of St. John Lateran while the Pope gave his benediction were the painter Giotto, and some say the poet Dante. The latter was no lover of Boniface, and portrayed him in hell. Giotto limited himself to recording the Jubilee in a fresco in the loggia, of which the central fragment can still be seen in today's basilica.
Another of the pilgrims was a Florentine merchant, Giovanni Villani, who kept a chronicle. He has left us a delightful account of the Jubilee.
In the year of Christ 1300, the Pope of the time, Pope Boniface VIII, Apostolic, did in the above-mentioned year, in reverence for the birth of Christ, make a sovereign and great indulgence. And this was the manner of it, that any Roman who should visit during that year, for 30 consecutive days, the churches of the blessed apostles Peter and Paul, and for 15 consecutive days all the other people who were not Romans, to all he granted full and entire pardon of all their sins, once they had confessed them, and remitted all fault and punishment. And for the consolation of the Christian pilgrims, every Friday or solemn feast day, the holy veil of Veronica would be shown in St. Peter's. And for this reason, a great number of Christians living at that time made this pilgrimage, men and women both, from various countries near and far. And it was the most wondrous thing that had ever been seen, that throughout the whole year there were in Rome, apart from the Roman people, 200,000 pilgrims, not counting those on the roads coming and going. And all of them were provided for, fed and housed in the right manner, the horses as well as the people, and with great patience and without noise or fights. And I can testify to this, who was present and saw it. And the offerings made by the pilgrims brought to the church great treasure, and all the Romans became rich.
Been listening to episode 20 of The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear the next episode, entitled The Long Absence, at this same time next week.